Chapter 8. On the same morning, or a couple of days later, on the terrace,
«Ma va donc jouer avec lui?»
said Mademoiselle La Riviere, pushing Ada, whose young hips disjointedly jerked from the shock.
«Don't let your cousin se morfondre when the weather is so fine. Take him by the hand. Go and show him the White Lady in your favorite lane, and the mountain, and the great oak.»
Ada turned to him with a shrug. The touch of her cold fingers and damp palm and the self-conscious way she tossed back her hair as they walked down the main avenue of the park made him self-conscious too, and under the pretext of picking up a fir cone, he disengaged his hand. He threw the cone at a woman of marble bending over a stamnos, but only managed to frighten a bird that had perched on the brim of her broken jar.
"There is nothing more banal in the world," said Ada, "than pitching stones at a hawfinch."
"Sorry," said Vaughn. "I did not intend to scare that bird. But then, I'm not a country lad. Who knows a cone from a stone? What games, au fond, does she expect us to play?"
"Je l'ignore," replied Ada. "I really don't care very much how her poor mind works. Cash cash, I suppose, or climbing trees?"
"Oh, I'm good at that," said Vaughn. "In fact, I can even brachiate."
"No," she said. "We are going to play my games. Games I have invented all by myself. Games Lucette, I hope, will be able to play next year with me, the poor pet. Come, let us start. The present series belongs to the Shadow and Shine group, two of which I'm going to show you."
"I see," said Vaughn.
"You will in a moment," rejoined the pretty prig. "First of all, we must find a nice stick."
"Look," said Vaughn, still smarting a bit, "there goes another haw-haw finch." By then they had reached the rond-point, a small arena encircled by flower beds and jasmine bushes in heavy bloom. Overhead, the arms of a linden stretched toward those of an oak, like a green-spangled beauty flying to meet her strong father, hanging by his feet from the trapeze. Even then, did we both understand that kind of heavenly stuff? Even then. "Something rather acrobatic about those branches up there, no?" he said, pointing.
"Yes," she answered. "I discovered it long ago. The teal is the flying Italian lady, and the old oak aches, the old lover aches, but still catches her every time." "Impossible to reproduce the right intonation while rendering the entire sense after 8 decades. But she did say something extravagant, something quite out of keeping with her tender age, as they looked up and then down.
Looking down and gesturing with a sharp green stake borrowed from the peonies, Ada explained the first game. The shadows of leaves on the sand were variously interrupted by roundlets of live light. The player chose his roundlet, the best, the brightest he could find, and firmly outlined it with the point of his stick, whereupon the yellow round light would appear to grow convex, like the brimming surface of some golden dye. Then the player delicately scooped out the earth with his stick or fingers within the roundlet. The level of that gleaming infusion de tilleul would magically sink in its goblet of earth and finally dwindle to one precious drop. That player won who made the most goblets in, say, 20 minutes. Vaughn asked suspiciously if that was all.
No, it was not.
As she dug a firm little circle around a particularly fine gold gout, Ada squatted and moved, squatting with her black hair falling over her ivory smooth moving knees, while her haunches and hands worked, one hand holding the stick, the other brushing back bothersome strands of hair. A gentle breeze suddenly eclipsed her fleck. When that occurred, the player lost one point, even if the leaf or the cloud hastened to move aside.
All right. What was the other game?
The other game, in a sing-song voice, might seem a little more complicated. To play it properly, one had to wait for PM to provide longer shadows. The player,
Stop saying the player. It is either you or me. Say you. You outline my shadow behind me on the sand. I move, you outline it again. Then you mark out the next boundary, handing him the stick. If I now move back...
You know, said Vaughn, throwing the stick away, personally, I think these are the most boring and stupid games anybody has ever invented anywhere, anytime, AM or PM.
She said nothing, but her nostrils narrowed. She retrieved the stick and stuck it back furiously where it belonged, deep into the loam next to a grateful flower to which she looped it with a silent nod. She walked back to the house. He wondered if her walk would be more graceful when she grew up.
I'm a rude, brutal boy. Please forgive me, he said.
She inclined her head without looking back. In token of partial reconciliation, she showed him two sturdy hooks passed into iron rings on two tulip tree trunks, between which, before she was born, another boy, also Ivan, her mother's brother, used to sling a hammock in which he slept in midsummer when the nights became really sultry. This was the latitude of Sicily, after all.
A splendid idea, said Vaughn. By the way, do fireflies burn one if they fly into you? I'm just asking, just a city boy's silly question.
She showed him next where the hammock, a whole set of hammocks, a canvas sack full of strong, soft nets, was stored. This was in the corner of a basement tool room behind the lilacs. The key was concealed in this hole here, which last year was stuffed by the nest of a bird. No need to identify it. A pointer of sunlight daubed with greener paint a long green box where croquet implements were kept, but the balls had been rolled down the hill by some rowdy children, the little Erminens, who were now Vaughn's age, and had grown very nice and quiet.
As we all are at that age, said Vaughn, and stooped to pick up a curved tortoiseshell comb, the kind that girls use to hold up their hair behind. He had seen one exactly like that quite recently.
But when? In whose hairdo?
One of the maids, said Ada. That tattered chapbook must also belong to her. Les Amours du Docteur Maître Vago. A mystical romance by a pastor.
Playing croquet with you, said Vaughn, should be rather like using flamingos and hedgehogs.
Our reading lists do not match, replied Ada. That Palace in Wonderland was to me the kind of book everybody so often promised me I would adore that I developed an insurmountable prejudice toward it. Have you read any of Mademoiselle La Riviere's stories?
Well, you will.
She thinks that in some former Hinduish state, she was a boulevardier in Paris, and writes accordingly. We can squirm from here into the front hall by a secret passage, but I think we are supposed to go and look at the Grand Chêne, which is really an elm.
Did he like elms?
Did he know Joyce's poem about the two washerwomen?
He did, indeed.
Did he like it?
He did. In fact, he was beginning to like very much arbors and ardors and odders.
They rhymed. Should he mention it?
And now, she said, and stopped, staring at him.
Yes, he said. And now?
Well, perhaps, I ought not to try to divert you, after you trampled upon those circles of mine, but I'm going to relent and show you the real marvel of Ardis Manor. My larvarium. It's in the room next to mine.
Which he never saw.
Never.
How odd, come to think of it.
She carefully closed the communicating door as they entered into what looked like a glorified rabbitry at the end of a marble-flagged hall, a converted bathroom, as it transpired. In spite of the place's being well-aired, with the heraldic stained glass windows standing wide open, so that one heard the screeching and catcalls of an undernourished and horribly frustrated bird population, the smell of the hutches, damp earth, rich roots, old greenhouse, and maybe a hint of goat, was pretty appalling.
Before letting him come nearer, Ada fiddled with little latches and grates, and a sense of great emptiness and depression replaced the sweet fire that had been consuming Van since the beginning of their innocent games on that day.
Je refole de tout ce qui rampe.
I'm crazy about everything that crawls, she said. Personally, said Van, I rather like those that roll up in a muff when you touch them. Those that go to sleep like old dogs.
Oh, they don't go to sleep, Kelly-day. They swoon. It's a little syncope, explained Ada, frowning. And I imagine it may be quite a little shock for the younger ones.
Yes, I can well imagine that, too. But I suppose one gets used to it by and by. I mean... But his ill-informed hesitations soon gave way to aesthetic empathy. Many decades later, Van remembered having much admired the lovely, naked, shiny, gaudily spotted and streaked shark moth caterpillars, as poisonous as the mullein flowers clustering around them, and the flat larva of a local catechalid, whose gray knobs and lilac plaques mimicked the knots and lichens of the twig to which it clung so closely as to practically lock with it. And, of course, the little vaporer fellow, its black cloak enlivened all along the back with painted tufts, red, blue, yellow, of unequal length, like those of a fancy toothbrush treated with certified colors. And that kind of simile, with those special trimmings, reminds me today of the entomological entries in Ada's diary, which we must have somewhere, mustn't we, darling? In that drawer there? No? You don't think so? Yes, hurrah! Samples. Your round-cheeked script, my love, was a little larger, but otherwise nothing, nothing, nothing has changed. The retractile head and diabolical anal appendages of the garish monster that produces the modest puss moth belong to a most uncaterpillarish caterpillar, with front segments shaped like bellows and a face resembling the lens of a folding camera. If you gently stroke its bloated, smooth body, the sensation is quite silky and pleasant, until the irritated creature ungratefully squirts at you an acrid fluid from a slit in its throat. Dr. Krolik received from Andalusia and kindly gave me 5 young larvae of the newly described very local Carmen tortoiseshell. They are delightful creatures of a beautiful jade nuance with silvery spikes, and they breed only on a semi-extinct species of high mountain willow, which dear Crawley also obtained for me. At 10 or earlier, the child had read, as Van had, Les Malheurs de Swan, as the next sample reveals. I think Marina would stop scolding me for my hobby. There's something indecent about a little girl's keeping such revolting pets. Normal young ladies should loathe snakes and worms, etc. If I could persuade her to overcome her old-fashioned squeamishness and place simultaneously on palm and pulse, the hand alone would not be roomy enough, the noble larva of the Cattleya hawk moth, mauve shades of Monsieur Proust, a 7-inch-long colossus, flesh-colored, with turquoise arabesques, rearing its hyacinth head in a stiff, Sphinxian attitude. Lovely stuff, said Van, but even I did not quite assimilate it when I was young. So let us not bore the boor who flips through a book and thinks, what a hoaxer, that old V.V. At the end of his so remote, so near, 1884 summer, Van, before leaving Ardis, was to make a visit of adieu to Ada's larvarium. The porcelain-white eye-spotted cowl or shark larva, a highly prized gem, had safely achieved its next metamorphosis, but Ada's unique Lorelei underwing had died, paralyzed by some ichneumon that had not been deceived by those clever prominences and fungoid smudges. The multicolored toothbrush had comfortably pupated within a shaggy cocoon, promising a Persian vaporer later in the autumn. The 2 puss moth larvae had assumed a still uglier, but at least more vermian and in a sense venerable aspect, their pitchforks now limply trailing behind them, and a purplish flush dulling the cubistry of their extravagant colors, they kept ramping rapidly all over the floor of their cage in a surge of prepupational locomotion. Aqua had walked through a wood and into a gulch to do it last year. A freshly emerged Nymphalis carmine was fanning its lemon and amber brown wings on a sunlit patch of grating, only to be choked with one nip by the nimble fingers of enraptured and heartless Ada. The Odetian Sphinx had turned, bless him, into an elephantoid mummy with a comically encased trunk of the Guermantoid type, and Dr. Krolik was swiftly running on short legs after a very special orange tip above the timberline in another hemisphere. Antikarkas Ada, Krolik, 1884, as it was known until changed to A. Pritwitzi Stumper, 1883, by the inexorable law of taxonomic priority. But afterwards, when all these beasties have hatched, asked Van, what do you do with them? Oh, she said, I take them to Dr. Krolik's assistant, who sets them and labels them and pins them in glassed trays in a clean oak cabinet, which will be mine when I marry. I shall then have a big collection and continue to breed all kinds of leps. My dream is to have a special institute of fritillary larvae and violets, all the special violets they breed on. I would have eggs or larvae rushed to me here by plane from all over North America, with their food plants, redwood violets from the West Coast and a pale violet from Montana, and a prairie violet and Eggleston's violet from Kentucky, and a rare white violet from a secret marsh near an unnamed lake on an Arctic mountain where Krolik's lesser fritillary flies. Of course, when the things emerge, they are quite easy to mate by hand. You hold them for quite a while sometimes, like this, in folded wing profile. Showing the method, ignoring her poor fingernails. Male in your left hand, female in your right, or vice versa, with the tips of their abdomens touching. But they must be quite fresh and soaked in their favorite violet's reek.